graphic audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. and J.A. Johnstone's Six Killer, U.S. Marshal. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Evan Casey, Kimberly Gilbert, Eric Messner, Alyssa Wilmoth, Michael John Casey, James Lewis, Christopher Graybill, Thomas Keegan, Dylan Lynch, David Coyne, Gary Tells, Tony Nam, James Konacek, Scott McCormick, Joe Brack, Nathaniel Perry, Drew Kopas, Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, and Ken Jackson. Six Killer, U.S. Marshal, Book 2, Day of Rage.
Six Killer! John Henry Six Killer, is that you?
John Henry was in Tahlequah, the capital of the Cherokee Nation in Indian Territory, and had quite a few friends here, and some enemies as well, because the two men who had come up behind him weren't nearly as jovial as that shout had made them sound. Both men were Indians, and John Henry saw a resemblance between them. Brothers.
What can I do for you fellows?
What can you do?
The shorter of the pair drew a pistol.
You can die. That's what you can do. Just like our brother Doyle done when you shot him, you damn lawman.
Now, hold on. It's true enough I'm a lawman. Chief Sheriff of the Cherokee Nation, in fact, and a Deputy U.S. Marshal to boot. So in which capacity was it that I shot your brother?
What in blazes does that matter?
Well, seeing as how you boys have the drop on me, and it's mighty unlikely that I'm going to survive the next couple of minutes, I'd really like to know why I'm about to die. What was your brother's name?
Doyle Hilltop. That was his name, you no-good badge
Doyle
tone.
Doyle Hilltop. Sure, I remember him. Held up a stagecoach and shot two people dead, as I recall. I surely do hate to speak ill of anybody's kin, especially after they've passed on, but your brother Doyle was not a good sort. When I went to arrest him, I told him that he had a choice. He could surrender and come back with me for trial, or I could shoot him dead. His pick. Obviously, you know what his decision was.
Caleb, are we just gonna stand here and let him run his mouth, or are we gonna shoot him like we said we were?
The second man raised a shotgun and pointed it at John.
We're gonna shoot him, of course. We said we wanted him to see it coming and know why he was dying, and now he does. You've run your mouth long enough. Time for you to die, lawman.
Now hold on. There's just one more thing.
What is it? You gonna get down on your knees and beg for your life, Six Killer?
No, I'm going to offer you a choice. You can put those guns down and let me take you to jail peacefully, or I'll shoot you dead. Up to you.
You son of a...
Caleb was shocked by the speed of the draw and didn't take time to aim.
You lousy...
Don't blame me. I gave you boys a perfectly reasonable choice.
John Henry!
John Henry recognized the voice and turned around. He saw Captain Charles LaFlores of the Cherokee Light Horse, the tribal police force, hurrying toward him, trailed by a couple of other policemen.
Hello, Captain. I reckon you heard the shooting.
Tahlequah's not so big that the sounds of a gun battle go unnoticed. Who'd you shoot now?
You mean who did I have to shoot? I gave them a choice, but they didn't give me one.
Uh-huh.
LaFlores looked past John Henry at the limp, motionless bodies.
So who are they?
The smaller one is Caleb Hilltop. The other one is his brother. I don't know his name.
Any relation to Doyle Hilltop?
He was their brother.
Well, that explains why they threw down on you then. You killed Doyle, as I recall.
That I did. In the line of duty.
Sure. Same as these two killings. John Henry, how long have you been in town?
Oh, about 5 minutes, I suppose.
Yeah, that's sort of what I thought. Were you headed to my office when these fellas interrupted your day by any chance?
I was.
Let's head over there then. I'll walk with you. I need to talk to you anyway.
About what?
I got a message for you from Judge Parker. He wants to see you in Fort Smith.
That's where I was headed when I left here.
Oh, well, the judge sounded like he was sort of in a big hurry to see you, John Henry. I don't think I'd linger too long in Tahlequah if I was you.
Well, if I didn't know better, I'd say that you were trying to get rid of me, Captain.
Well, I guess it's good for the Undertaker, but the bodies do tend to pile up a mite whenever you're around.
Southwestern New Mexico Territory, several weeks earlier. The two men on the wagon kept glancing around nervously as the vehicle rolled down a fairly steep mountain trail toward the plains below, where the settlement of Purgatory was located. Four men on horseback rode with the wagon, two ahead and two behind. They were equally wary. They had good reason to be worried. In the back of the wagon, covered with canvas, was a cargo of gold bullion from the San Francisco mine, named after the mountains that loomed above them and the river that ran through the valley to the east. They didn't have to be concerned about just any would-be thief who came along, though. In these parts, one group seemed to hold a monopoly on lawlessness, the gang of kill-crazy bandits led by Billy Ray Gilmore. It had gotten to the point that not many men wanted the job of accompanying no shipments. The chore was just too blasted dangerous these days. Jason True had been forced to double the wages these men were going to collect for taking the gold to Purgatory. Beads of sweat stood out on their faces as they headed down the trail toward Purgatory, and that didn't have anything to do with the heat.
They always hit in the mountains.
The speaker was the driver of the wagon, Chet Simmons.
We can make it to the flats, we'll be all right.
The shotgun guard next to him, Jack Whitfield, swallowed hard and tightened his grip on the double-barreled weapon he held across his lap.
How much longer before we're down from here?
20 minutes, maybe. Can't rush those mules. Steep as the trail is, we try and go too fast, wagon will get away from us. Wouldn't want to run over those boys riding ahead of us.
Yeah, don't want to get ambushed either.
Something made Whitfield turn his head and look up to the left. The slope in that direction ran upward for maybe 100 feet before it leveled off into a narrow shoulder. A few pretty good-sized boulders perched on the edge of that shoulder. As Whitfield watched, one of those boulders moved, rocking back and forth for a second and then overbalancing, toppling forward to roll down the mountainside.
Look out, Chet!
The two outriders in front of the wagon jerked back on their reins and wheeled their mounts, which was a mistake. More rocks were already crashing down toward the wagon and the men accompanying it. Simmons brought the wagon to a halt. One of the fallen rocks landed on the wagon team. Another was headed straight for the driver's seat. Simmons and Whitfield dived off the vehicle. Whitfield looked in the direction of the shots and saw half a dozen riders charging down at them. The two remaining outriders were quickly cut down.
Simmons! What do we... Stop!
Looks like you're out of luck, amigo.
Billy Ray, this is too damn much like work.
Duke Rudd and the other men loaded bullion into pouches slung over the backs of the pack mules they'd brought down the trail.
First, some of us have to sweat like field hands levering those boulders off the rim up there. And now we got to tote all this heavy gold. Now, if the team hadn't gotten squashed, we could have just turned the wagon around and hauled the loot away in it.
Unfortunately, you can't really aim a boulder too well. We knew we'd probably have to pack the bullion out. That's why we were ready.
I know. And I reckon I shouldn't complain about having to tote gold. It's just we're outlaws. Idea is we take what we want from other folks so we don't have to work for it ourselves.
That's true. But there's one thing you've got to remember, Duke. Nothing's free in this world. You may think you've had a fortune fall right in your lap and it's all due to good luck. But somehow, sometime, you still got to pay a price for it. We're paying that price today by having to load up this gold.
Well, some of us are paying it.
My part of the pan was coming up with the idea in the first place.
Well, how much you reckon this bullion's worth?
Plenty. It was worth the lives of five men, I know that much. And here's the best part. There's more where that came from.
The Barrymore House was the best hotel in Purgatory. It was also the only real hotel, since the other places in town that rented rooms were attached to saloons, and the men who stayed there were just as interested in whiskey and whores as they were in a place to sleep. Jason True had a home in Santa Fe, but he kept a suite in the hotel in Purgatory, too, because he was here quite a bit of the time tending to the business of the San Francisco Mining Company, of which he was the president and chief stockholder. Sometimes when people heard the name, they assumed that his mine must be in California, and he had to explain that San Francisco was also the name of the mountain range that ran just east of the border between New Mexico and Arizona territories. This evening, his hand shook a little as he poured brandy from a crystal decanter into three heavy tumblers. True was a man with a stiff-backed stance, a holdover from his days as a colonel in the army, iron-gray hair and a neatly clipped mustache. He handed one of the tumblers to Arnold Goodman, another to Dan Lacey, and kept the third one for himself.
I'd say cheers, but there's absolutely nothing to celebrate tonight. Absolutely nothing.
You're right about that.
Goodman was short and wide, built like a tree stump, and his face was about as blunt and hard as a stump, too. He was from back east someplace. True didn't know exactly where. And a few years earlier, he had bought the struggling El Halcón mine from the Mexican ranchero who'd originally owned it as part of a land-grant legacy. The gamble had paid off for Goodman, not so much for the ranchero. A couple of months later, workers in El Halcón had come across a previously undiscovered vein of ore that had made the mine quite successful.
Do you know how much you lost, Jason?
Like True, Lacey was originally from the Midwest, a wiry, balding man who ran the Bonita Mining Corporation with an iron fist, despite his mild appearance.
The bullion hadn't been weighed and assayed yet, of course. $8,000, perhaps? A significant amount, certainly.
But not as much as you stood to lose if you send down all the bullion you have on hand.
That's true. But the bullion doesn't do me a damned bit of good sitting up there at my mine, either.
The three men had gathered here in the sitting room of True's suite at the Barrymore House. True had sent for his fellow mine owners as soon as he received word of the attack on his gold wagon that afternoon.
I think it's time we go ahead with what we talked about before. The three of us have always been rivals, but we're going to have to put that aside.
We've been rivals, but not enemies. There's a big difference. I'm perfectly willing to work together on this matter.
Goodman frowned, but didn't say anything.
How about it, Arnold? What do you think?
It goes against the grain to help the competition. That's not the way I've done business all these years. But it's obvious none of us can handle this by ourselves. Maybe if we throw in together, we can stop these damned outlaws from bankrupting us.
Maybe that's worth saying cheers to, Arnold Goodman actually being reasonable.
All right. We each have approximately $25,000 worth of gold bullion at our mines in the mountains. If the three of us go in together, we can hire enough guards to transport that bullion safely down here to Purgatory, one mine at a time.
Where it'll have to sit and wait until the gold from the other mines is brought down. I don't like that part very much.
That worries me a little too, Jason.
The bullion will be locked up securely in the bank. It'll be guarded around the clock. Gilmore won't try for it right here in the middle of town.
Are you sure about that? He and his men don't seem to mind coming into town and running roughshod over the citizens anytime they want. You can be sure that Hinkle's not going to do anything about it. How did a man like that ever become marshal anyway? He's nothing but a blasted coward.
Nobody else wanted the job. Gilmore and his bunch hadn't shown up yet to make our lives miserable, of course, but Purgatory was still a pretty wild place. How do you think it got its name? The respectable citizens insisted that the town had to have a marshal, but they couldn't find anybody who'd take the badge until Henry Hinkle did it.
Not exactly a town tamer, is he?
Maybe not, but things did improve a little. My personal feeling is that all the folks who'd been raising hell looked at Hinkle and realized they'd be embarrassed to shoot down such a, well, such a craven coward. I sometimes think that's all that kept Hinkle alive.
And that's what we have to rely on for law and order around here. No wonder it's become clear that we're going to have to take things into our own hands. It's agreed then, gentlemen? We pool our resources, do whatever is necessary to get our gold down here, and then ship it out at the same time with Wells Fargo.
Agreed.
Goodman just jerked his blocky head in a nod.
All right. I think we ought to have another drink on that.
Billy Ray Gilmore downed a shot of whiskey, set the empty glass on the hardwood in front of him, and patted the shapely rump of the bar girl called Della, who was leaning close beside him.
Why don't you take me upstairs?
I'm afraid I don't have the time right now, darling. I gotta see a man about a horse.
Della pouted prettily. She was a honey blonde, about 20 years old. She'd been working in saloons for a short enough time that she still had her looks. Her fresh-faced beauty made her popular, and normally Gilmore would have been glad to go upstairs with her. But he was in purgatory tonight on business.
I'm disappointed, Billy Ray. I had my heart set on spending some time with you tonight.
No need to feel like that. You know there's a dozen men in here who'd fall all over their boots for a chance to take you upstairs.
Yeah, but none of them is Billy Ray Gilmore.
I am a notorious individual, aren't I?
It was an odd situation. The first few jobs Gilmore and his gang had pulled in this part of the territory, they'd always worn masks. People had a pretty good idea who was responsible for those holdups, but nobody could stand up in court and testify beyond a doubt that Billy Ray and his boys were the culprits. They weren't as careful about concealing their identities these days, but they didn't leave many witnesses alive either. And by now, folks were too scared to identify them, afraid that would mean a bullet in the back some dark night, or a house burned down around them. So the county sheriff, Elmer Stone, had no real evidence to go on. Purgatory's marshal, Henry Hinkle. Well, Hinkle was worthless no matter how you looked at it. Anyway, Gilmore and his men hadn't committed any serious crimes inside the town limits. So for now, they came and went as they pleased, enjoying the comforts and entertainment the town had to offer, such as the Silver Spur Saloon where Gilmore was at the moment.
I'll see you later.
Gilmore walked a block or so, and then turned down a dark alley. He followed it to the rear of a building and stood there waiting until a door opened somewhere nearby and let a shaft of light spill out.
Are you out there?
I'm here. Everything go as planned?
Exactly as planned. Give it a few weeks and we're both going to be very rich men, my friend.
I like the sound of that.
Fort Smith, Arkansas. The town of Fort Smith perched on a bluff overlooking the winding course of the Arkansas River. It was the gateway to Indian territory, which to some people meant that it was the last outpost of civilization. Those people were somewhat ignorant, because the Indians who made their homes over there in the territory weren't called the Five Civilized Tribes for no reason. In many ways, the Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, and Seminole were just as civilized as their white brethren. They had schools, churches, businesses, farms, and ranches. They had their own written language and their own newspaper. They lived in towns and dressed much like the white men dressed. And in some ways, John Henry Sixkiller mused as he rode into Fort Smith, the tribes were more civilized than the whites. After all, they had never forced their peaceful neighbors to pick up and move for no good reason, never driven an entire people into a pilgrimage over a route that took so many lives it came to be known as the Trail of Tears, as the whites had done with their Indian Removal Act. John Henry felt no personal animosity toward white people because of that history. For one thing, he was half white himself. His father, James Sixkiller, had met his mother, Elizabeth, during the trip west and married her after the two of them fell in love. John Henry had been born in Indian Territory. It was the only real home he'd ever known. And while he knew from listening to the old-timers that Indian Territory was considerably different from the lush forests of the East, it turned out to be pretty good land that would support people if they were willing to work. And Indians, despite the reputation they had with some as lazy, were always willing to work hard when it came to taking care of their families, John Henry knew. He rode straight to the big red brick federal courthouse where Judge Isaac C. Parker had his office. As a member of the Cherokee Light Horse, John Henry's jurisdiction had been restricted to Indian territory, and he wasn't allowed to arrest white criminals or even to interfere with them. A rule he had bent from time to time when the situation made it necessary. When Judge Parker had offered to appoint him as a Deputy United States Marshal, John Henry had accepted with no hesitation. For one thing, that appointment had saved him from being tried for murder and the deaths of two white outlaws he'd been forced to shoot. For another, with the power of the federal government behind him, he could go after the desperados who plagued the frontier, whether they were red, white, black, or brown, and stay on their trail no matter where they went. That sort of freedom was very important to someone like John Henry, who was determined to bring law and order to the West.
Come in.
Marshal Sixkiller. Good to see you. Did you just get here?
That's right.
Parker motioned John Henry into a leather chair in front of the desk.
Then you missed all the excitement. We had some prisoners try to escape.
I'm sorry I wasn't here to lend a hand.
Oh, that's all right. A couple of Texans pitched in and helped us round them up. I wanted to see you on an entirely different matter. That's why I sent a note to Captain Aflores asking him to send you directly here if he saw you.
Yes, sir. I came as soon as I heard. What can I do for you?
Here it is.
Parker picked up one of the pieces of paper.
This is a letter from an old friend of mine. His name is Jason True. Have you heard of him?
No, sir, I don't think so.
Well, no reason you should have. He owns a gold mine in New Mexico territory, near the Arizona border. Rugged country, from what I hear, and virtually lawless.
I imagine so.
It seems that Jason and the other mine owners in the area have been having trouble with a gang of outlaws stealing their gold shipments. They bring the gold down from the mountains where the mines are located to a settlement called Purgatory.
That doesn't sound promising.
The town is well named, from what I know of. From Purgatory, the gold is taken to Lordsburg, shipped out by rail with Wells Fargo. Ultimately, of course, it winds up at the Mint in Denver. Therefore, any interference with that gold falls under federal jurisdiction. In approximately 1 week's time, Jason and the other two large mine owners, men named Goodman and Lacey, are going to pool their resources and assemble a massive shipment of gold in Purgatory. Wells Fargo has agreed to take responsibility for it there.
That sounds a little risky. Like the old saying about putting all your eggs in one basket.
Well, they believe that the gold will be safe there if they can get it to town. All the holdups so far have taken place between the mines and Purgatory. Instead of each mine owner hiring guards to bring down their gold, they're going in together to hire a large enough force to keep it safe. It seems like a plan with a reasonable chance of success.
Maybe. You can't ever predict what some bandit's going to do, though.
No, of course not. But there's a risk in anything.
And I'd still be worried about having that much gold in one place. How much did you say it's going to amount to, Judge?
I didn't. But Jason estimates the total will be around $75,000.
That's a mighty big pile of gold, Your Honor. If it belonged to me, if even a third of it belonged to me, I'd be more than worried. I'd be downright scared.
That's why Jason wrote to me. Since any attempt to steal the gold would be a federal crime, he asked if I could send him a deputy marshal to help protect it.
New Mexico territory is sort of out of our bailiwick, isn't it?
Normally, yes. Jason should have sent his request to the chief marshal in Denver. But as I said, Jason, he's an old friend, so he turned to me instead. There's another angle to consider, too. Whoever is sent to Purgatory to look after that gold might be able to do so more effectively if it's not widely known that he's a federal officer. That way, if the outlaws do make a play for it, he can take them by surprise.
Begging your pardon, Judge, but I think I can see the trail you're laying down here. You want me to go to New Mexico and make sure that gold gets where it's supposed to go?
That's the idea, yes. Your record speaks for itself, Deputy Sixkiller. Despite your relative youth, you're an experienced lawman, and you found yourself in a number of tight spots. The fact that you're still here says something about your abilities.
And nobody in New Mexico is liable to recognize me as a deputy marshal, that's for sure.
Exactly. Because of my friendship with Jason, I consider this to be a personal matter, at least to an extent. So I'm loath to make it an order.
No need to worry about that, Your Honor. A federal lawman has jurisdiction anywhere in the country, right?
That's right. Your badge means just as much in New Mexico as it does here.
There's one problem, though. Ironheart's pretty fast, but I don't think he can get all the way from here to the other side of New Mexico in a week.
We'll put you on the train. You can be in Lordsburg in a couple of days. Jason can reimburse the federal government for that expense. There's a stagecoach from Lordsburg to Purgatory.
That sounds pretty good. But I was wondering, is there any chance you could put Ironheart on the train too, and I could ride him to Purgatory? I can make almost as good time that way as traveling by stagecoach.
Jason can pay the freight on that horse of yours too, if that's the way you want it. What do you say, Deputy?
I say I'm on my way to New Mexico.
In Purgatory, Duke Rudd and Sam Logan were bored. Both men had been outlaws since they were in their teens. And when they weren't busy robbing and killing, sometimes they found that they didn't know what to do with themselves. And Billy Ray just kept telling them to be patient, claiming that there was a big job coming up, but the time wasn't right for it yet. So here they sat at a table in the Silver Spur, nursing beers.
Might as well be in a damn cemetery. It's sure enough dead in here.
It's early. The place will get busier later on.
Well, what if I don't want to wait for later on? What if I want some excitement right now?
Then I guess you'll have to manufacture your own. Why don't you take one of the gals upstairs?
Because the only one down here right now is that damn Linda Sue. I swear my horse is better looking than her. Anyway, I'm a mite low on funds.
No. Billy Ray don't give us enough spending money. As much loot as we've got stashed at that hideout, seems like we ought to be flush all the time.
He says he wants to save it up, and not to do the divvy until we're ready to rattle our hocks and shake the dust of New Mexico off our boots. Well, how long is that gonna be, I ask you? How much is enough?
Money's like sweet loving from a gal. Ain't no such thing as enough.
Yeah, maybe so. But I'm getting tired of just sitting around and waiting. All right.
All right, what? What's going on?
Rudd nodded toward the staircase at the side of the big bar room.
Look who woke up and coming downstairs.
The pretty blonde called Della was descending the stairs. As Rudd and Logan watched her, she stifled a yawn. Her hair had been brushed, but was still a little tousled from sleep. She paused halfway down, grasped the low neckline of her dress, and gave it a tug to adjust it over her breasts.
Lord, you ever had her, Sam?
Nope. She charges more than the other gals, and she can get away with it, too, looking like she does. Besides, I think she's kind of sweet on Billy Ray. She's always hanging all over him when he's in here.
Yeah, but he ain't sweet on her, is he? I mean, she don't mean nothing special to him. I never knew Billy Ray to get moony-eyed over a gal in particular, so he had not a mind if I was to spend some time in Miss Della's company.
I thought you said you didn't have enough money.
Well, I've been saving some back for something special. And if that ain't special, I never seen anything that is.
Now go ahead. Don't be surprised if she laughs in your face, though.
Why in the hell would she do that?
Because you're about the ugliest peckerwood south of the picket wire.
I reckon I'll shoot you for saying that, Sam. One of these days I will. You just wait and see. But not today. Today, I got more important business to take care of.
Well, you do that.
Rudd walked over to where Della stood next to the bar.
Good day to you, Miss Della. Remember me, Duke Rudd? We spoke before.
Why, of course I remember you. Duke, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine, I reckon. But, I'd be even finer if you'd go upstairs with me and allow me the pleasure of your company for a spell.
Duke, I'm flattered, but it's early in the day and I really haven't been awake that long.
It's afternoon.
Well, that's early for me, honey. Besides, I sort of doubt that you'd be able to afford me.
How much?
Della glanced at the bartender. Rudd thought she might have been appealing to Meade to get rid of him, but the man pointedly looked away and started wiping the bar with a rag, each movement taking him a little farther away. The message was clear. He wasn't going to interfere with one of Billy Ray Gilmore's men.
$10.
Rudd reached into his pocket and brought out a $10 gold piece. He slapped the eagle on the bar.
There you go.
Fine. Let's go.
Della turned and led the way toward the stairs. Rudd divided his time between watching the appealing sway of her rear end in the tight dress and smirking in triumph at Logan, who sat there open-mouthed.
You don't get anything special for that price, so don't even think about it.
Oh, just being with you is special enough for me, darling.
Della put the gold piece on the table next to a basin of water.
Unbutton my dress for me.
Oh, I'd be glad to.
His blunt fingers weren't really meant for delicate work, though, and in his eagerness he fumbled even more than he might have otherwise.
Hang on. I'm getting it.
Sure hope you're better at other things than you are at this, Duke.
For some reason, that really rubbed him the wrong way. Ever since he'd walked up to her at the bar, she'd been talking to him like she looked down on him. So without thinking much about what he was doing, he grasped her dress where he had already gotten a couple of the buttons unfastened and wrenched the fabric in opposite directions.
Hey! What the hell?
Rudd gave her a hard shove that sent her sprawling face down on the bed. He threw himself on top of her and planted a hand on the back of her head, shoving her face into the bedding.
I don't want no damn whore! Talk to me that way!
His other hand tore the shift from her. Her right hand slid under the pillow and came out with a straight razor that she opened with a practiced flick of her wrist. She swiped back with it, and he felt the blade's fiery bite on his thigh where it sliced through his jeans and into his flesh. She rolled over on the bed, moving fast, and slashed at him again, but this time he was able to grab her wrist. The brutal twist made her hand open. The razor fell to the mattress. Rudd swept it off onto the floor.
You're gonna pay for what you've done. I might even take my $10 back. You're gonna have to work mighty hard to convince me I shouldn't cut you too like you did me. I could fix it so no man ever wants you again, missy.
I'm sorry. You just took me by surprise. I'll make it up to you. I swear.
Well, now that's more like it. What you gonna do to make it up to me? Show me!
She did, and while she was at it, he couldn't see her eyes anymore. If he'd been able to, he might have been worried, because in their green depths lurked the promise that someday he was going to pay for what he'd done, sure enough, and not with money either. John Henry was on the train riding toward his final destination when someone sat down on the bench seat beside him. He looked over and saw a thickly built, middle-aged man with curly, graying hair under a pushed-back derby. The man wore a dusty town suit.
Mexico.
What?
Mexico. That's what you're looking at. Those mountains over there on the other side of the border. You can't see it from here. The Rio Grande runs between us and them.
All right. They look just like the mountains on this side of the border, don't they?
Yeah, I guess they do. Mitchum's the name. Thaddeus Mitchum. Most folks call me Doc.
Because you're a doctor?
Oh, shoot, no. In my younger days, I was a traveling man. Sold elixirs and patent medicines.
Snake oil, in other words.
Wow, you're a plain-spoken young man, aren't you?
I try to be. I mean no offense by it, though.
Oh, none taken. I've been called much worse than a snake oil salesman in my time. But as a point of fact, the nostrums I sold actually did bring some relief to people who bought them.
Mix enough alcohol and opium in something, and that'll do it.
Indeed. I don't believe I caught your name, friend.
It's John Henry Six Killer.
Six Killer? You're an Indian?
Half.
Oh, well, that's fine. You may run into some people out here who are bothered by that, but I'm not one of them. I've studied history enough to know that most people are mongrels of one sort or another. I mean, nothing derogatory by the word. Where is it you're bound, if you don't mind my asking?
A little town in New Mexico territory called Purgatory.
Yes, I've heard of it. Never been there, though. It's a mining town, isn't it?
I think so.
Going there on business? You didn't mention what line of work you're in.
No, I didn't.
Mitchum seemed to take the hint. He stood up.
Perhaps I'll see you again later. Good luck on your journey, Mr. Six Killer.
You too.
Mitchum moved off along the aisle that ran through the center of the car. John Henry leaned back against the hard seat and closed his eyes, tipping his hat down over them. Even though he hadn't been awake all that long, the sleep he had gotten sitting up really hadn't been all that restful either. Besides, the gently rocking motion of the train and the monotonous clicking of the joints in the rails combined to make him drowsy. A nap wouldn't hurt anything, he told himself. He dozed off and didn't dream. He expected he might sleep all the way to El Paso. That turned out not to be the case. He didn't know how long he'd been asleep when he sensed someone else sitting down beside him. He opened his right eye, only the tiniest slit, trying to get a glimpse of his fellow passenger. If Doc Mitchum was back, John Henry intended to go right on sleeping, or at least pretending to do so. He didn't want to have to entertain the old medicine show con man. To his surprise, the person sitting beside him seemed to be wearing a dress, some sort of bottle green traveling outfit, to be precise. Still slumped against the seat, with the hat partially shielding his face, John Henry opened his eye a little more and let his gaze trail up the woman's body. He could see the curve of her bosom and above it her chin, and a fine chin it was, too, with a hint of firmness and determination about it. He couldn't see the rest of her face, though, unless he lifted his head and revealed that he was awake. He was debating whether or not he wanted to do that when he felt the soft pressure of her shoulder against his.
Please, sir. You have to help me, I beg of you.
Under those circumstances, John Henry didn't see how he could pretend to go on sleeping. He sat up straighter, opened his eyes all the way, and lifted a hand to thumb his hat back into its normal position. He turned his head to look at the woman sitting close beside him. Improperly close, some people would have said. She was very attractive. Probably about 23 years old, he would have guessed. Although, like most men, he was far from an expert at guessing a woman's age. Lustrous brown hair was pushed back and up to form an elaborate arrangement of curls upon which sat a stylish hat that matched her traveling dress. Her eyes were a rich, warm shade of brown, too. Her face had a small beauty mark just to the right of her mouth that only added to her striking looks.
Can you help me?
Help you to do what?
There's a man. He's bothering me.
How long will it be before we get to El Paso?
What? How long to El Paso? I don't know. Another hour or two, maybe?
Sorry, I just got distracted for a second. What were you saying about needing my help?
There's a man who's been watching me ever since we left San Antonio. He's very bold about it, and he makes me uncomfortable. I moved from the car where I was sitting originally, but he followed me. And then he spoke to me.
I'm speaking to you. It doesn't seem so bad.
Yes, but he wanted to know if I was stopping in El Paso. He suggested that he and I... Well, I don't want to repeat what he suggested, but I found it very offensive.
Is he in this car?
I don't know. I think he followed me.
The young woman looked, then jerked her head around so she was facing forward again.
Yes! He's back there! He's a big man with a large nose and a black mustache.
John Henry looked. There was an hombre several rows back who matched that description all right, but he didn't seem to be paying any attention to them.
Do you want me to go talk to him and ask him to leave you alone?
Oh, could you?
Of course. First, though, I'd like for you to tell me your name.
Is that really necessary?
I think it is.
Very well. My name is Sophie. Sophie Clearwater.
Clearwater sounded a little like an Indian name. John Henry knew it could just as easily be a white person's name, though. She didn't look the least bit Indian.
All right, Miss Clearwater. It is Miss Clearwater, isn't it?
Oh, that's right. I'm not married.
All right. I'll go have a word with the gentleman.
Oh, he's not a gentleman. He's a brute.
And I'll talk to him nonetheless.
John Henry got to his feet.
Why don't you just scoot on over there by the window? Easier for me to get out that way. I'll be right back.
John Henry felt the motion of the train under his boots as he walked along the aisle. The man Sophie Clearwater claimed to be afraid of sat by himself on one of the benches looking out the window. John Henry stopped beside him.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah? What do you want?
I was wondering if I could have a word with you.
What about? I don't know you, do I?
No, but it's important. If I could.
The man grimaced and slid over with obvious reluctance. He made it plain he didn't want any company.
Now, here's the situation. There's a young woman up there. You see her? Brown hair, green hat. She's not looking this way.
Yeah, I see her. What about it?
Are you acquainted with her?
Not that I know of. I can't see her face, so I'm not sure. But as far as I know, I'm not acquainted with anybody on this train. That includes you, mister.
I neglected to introduce myself. My name's John Henry Sixkiller. And yes, before you ask, I'm part Indian.
I don't give a hoot about that. Get to the point before I call the conductor.
Well, you see, that young woman claims that you've been bothering her. A You looked boldly at her, made improper suggestions, and followed her from another car to this one. Is there any truth to those charges?
The man's face had begun to flush with anger as John Henry spoke, and by the time he was finished, the man looked like he was about to explode. He opened his mouth to say something.
Quietly now. You don't want to cause an unnecessary scene.
You've already done that by coming back here and leveling these ridiculous accusations at me. I never bothered any woman like that, and I don't appreciate her saying that I did.
Is there any way you can prove that?
I don't have to prove anything.
Maybe not, but it would help me out if you did.
All right. My name is Harlan Phillips. I'm the pastor of a Baptist church in El Paso. I'm on my way back from San Antonio, where I attended a denominational meeting where I was cited for my work in the service of the Lord. I'm happily married and have 5 children. Is that enough proof for you, mister?
Am I supposed to take your word for it that you're this Pastor Phillips?
The man reached under his coat and John Henry tensed. If that hand came out with a gun in it, he was going to throw a punch before the men could bring the weapon to bear. Instead, Phillips, if that was his name, was holding an envelope. He showed it to John Henry, who saw that it was addressed to Harlan Phillips, Grace Baptist Church, El Paso, Texas.
Just because you've got a letter addressed to this Pastor Phillips doesn't mean you're him.
Maybe not. Why don't you bring the young woman back here and I'll address her accusations directly?
I don't believe that'll be necessary. I'll accept that you're who you say you are, Brother Harlan, if you'll do me a favor.
What sort of favor?
Don't argue with me when I say what I'm about to say.
John Henry got to his feet and pointed his hat at him.
And don't you forget it!
Then he clapped his hat on his head, gave Phillips a curt nod, and turned to stride back up the aisle to his seat.
You don't have anything else to worry about. I gave the man a good talking to, and he won't bother you anymore.
Oh, thank you. You're a true gentleman. Now I shouldn't take up any more of your time.
I don't have anything but time until we get to El Paso, and I'd be honored if you'd spend it talking with me, Miss Clearwater.
Oh, well, I suppose
And the first thing we can talk about is why you lied to me and told me that a fine, upstanding Baptist preacher with a wife and 5 children was making improper advances towards you.
Just because a man's a preacher doesn't mean he can't sin.
Anybody can sin. Some people do it like breathing. I've even heard it said that preachers are good at sinning because they've studied it so much. That doesn't answer my question.
You think that he's telling the truth and I'm lying?
I do, yes. I also think that you went through my carpet bag while I was talking to the good pastor. Find anything interesting?
Are you accusing me of being a thief?
Well, a would-be thief anyway. I doubt if you took anything, since I don't really have anything worth stealing.
Please let me out of this seat right now.
Not until you tell me the truth.
I'll scream. The conductor will come.
Go ahead. I wouldn't mind having a word with him myself.
Her hand moved slightly. He saw the twin barrels of an over and under Derringer peeking out at him from her fingers.
I don't want to shoot you.
And I don't want to be shot.
Moving so quickly she couldn't stop him, his hand clamped over hers and forced it down, so if she pulled the trigger, the bullet would go into the bench between them. He reached across his body with the other hand and tightened his grip. He plucked the Derringer from her grasp. As she glared at him, he let go of her, broke the little gun open, removed the shells, and handed it back to her.
I don't like people pointing guns at me. Not even beautiful women.
You son of a...
Now that's not very ladylike. But if you want to start calling names, I reckon I could come up with a few to apply to you as well.
All right, yes, I looked through your carpet bag, but it didn't take anything.
And Brother Harlan back there hasn't been bothering you, has he?
He's really a preacher?
Seems to be.
I just picked the meanest looking man I could find, and he turns out to be a blasted sky pilot.
That was an unfortunate turn of events for you.
You gonna turn me over to the law?
What for? You didn't take anything. And if you could get in trouble with the law for lying to a man, all the women in the world would be behind bars, wouldn't they?
Oh, that's a rather cynical attitude, isn't it?
Not really. Because if the reverse was true, all the men would be locked up.
So you have no faith in humanity at all, is that it?
Let's just say that my belief in the goodness of humankind has its limits.
If you're not gonna have me arrested, can you let me out of this seat?
So you can find some other poor, unsuspecting gent to rob between here and El Paso? No. I think we'll just continue our conversation as I suggested earlier. For starters, is your name really Sophie Clearwater?
As a matter of fact, it is.
My name is John Henry Sixkiller. Now that we've been properly introduced, tell me, do you do this sort of thing often?
That's none of your business.
Nope, I suppose not. But you can't blame me for being curious.
You wouldn't believe what a woman has to do sometimes to get along in this world. Believe me, Mr. Six Killer, there are worse ways than lifting an occasional wallet or watch.
I'm sure that's true. That's a fairly expensive traveling outfit you're wearing, though. You must not be completely broke.
I never said that I was. But at this particular moment, I don't own much more than the clothes on my back.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Sorry enough to perhaps help me out? No, forget I said that. Force of habit. And you wouldn't fall for it anyway.
Nope, I would not. Where are you from?
North Carolina, originally. Little town you never heard of.
Probably not, since I doubt that I could name a single town in North Carolina.
What about you? There's something unusual about you.
I'm half Cherokee. Born and raised in Indian Territory.
You don't look like any Indian I ever seen.
We don't all wear feathers and war paint. My father's people are one of the so-called civilized tribes. We live in houses, not buffalo hide lodges.
I should have guessed with a name like Six Killer.
I thought you might be part Indian as well, with a descriptive name like Clearwater.
No, my ancestors were English.
Ah, dukes and earls.
More like indentured servants and criminals. So you see, I come by it honestly.
Just because your ancestors were one thing doesn't mean you have to be, too. That's one of the good things about this country.
Suppose not. But there's an old saying about the apple not falling far from the tree.
Maybe you'd like to have some lunch with me while we're stopped.
Thank you, but no. I'm meeting someone in El Paso.
Well, my loss.
You can say that even though I tried to rob you?
But you didn't rob me, and that's the whole point.
Not for lack of trying.
If everybody was condemned for what they tried to do but failed.
I know, the whole world would be locked up.
Half of it, anyway.
Thank you. You've been a real gentleman about this whole thing.
Would it do any good to ask you to stop doing things like this?
What do you think, Mr. Six Killer?
I think I wish you the best, Miss Clearwater.
And the same to you.
After the train made a final stop in a town called Lourdes, John Henry claimed his horse from the livery car and made the ride into Purgatory. It was a decent-sized town with a mean street lined with businesses that stretched for three blocks and a couple of side streets where the residences were located. Most of the buildings were made of logs or lumber, but John Henry saw a few constructed out of brick, including an impressive edifice that had to be the bank, along with some made from adobe or chunks of native stone mortared together. One of those stone buildings, a squat, squarish structure, had a sign on it that read, Marshal's Office and Jail. A smaller sign underneath it proclaimed, Henry Hinkle, Marshal. John Henry wondered if he ought to introduce himself and reveal his true identity to the local lawman. Judge Parker hadn't said anything about this fella Hinkle, so John Henry didn't know what sort of a man he was. If he'd been in Hinkle's place, though, he knew he wouldn't appreciate it if a federal officer came into his bailiwick on an assignment without him knowing about it. This would require some scouting around, he decided. He would try to find out more about Henry Hinkle before spilling the truth to the man. He rode past the impressive brick building he had taken for the bank, and fancy gilt lettering on one of the front windows confirmed that the establishment was the First Territorial Bank of Purgatory. Not only the first, but also the only bank in town, as far as he could see, John Henry mused. He took note of several other businesses, including an assay office, several mercantiles, a couple of stores that sold hardware and mining equipment, a blacksmith, a pair of stables, a newspaper office, two cafes, a nicer-looking restaurant, a hotel called the Barrymore House, and at least half a dozen saloons, the biggest and fanciest of which appeared to be the Silver Spur. John Henry was easing Ironheart along the street at a walk and debating what to do next when the decision was made for him.